Today in the Open Studio podcast series, we're introducing Alice Bucknell, an artist and writer based in London. Using tactics of speculative fiction and working primarily through game engines and world-building strategies, her work challenges contemporary ideas of technological utopias and addresses architecture's role in the climate crisis. First off, I would like to say that I like your videos a lot, and these CGI images and renderings resemble some developers' visions projected as adverts, but the narrator's voice in them doesn't fully validate these architectural ideas. So if not for slightly awkward phrases such as "allow yourself to spend these dark times in style" or "experience the natural splendor before it's too late," one might feel like these visions would be actual videos used online to promote some real-life properties. Even though your work then refers to non-existing or speculative realities or dystopian visions, there's a number of actual references, landmarks from Florida, the United States, like a peculiar hotel resembling a huge guitar, or an example from Herzog and de Meuron's architecture. And so it seems that these possible futures already by now seem to have come true and can be especially seen in the residential development visions or mixed-use developments, like solar-powered, carbon-free smart home in highly regenerated urban areas and simulated ecosystems they seem to refer to. Maybe I'm not gonna say too much, but in the newest video, Swamp City, one of the protagonists is an architect deeply entangled in contributing to apocalyptic visions he has to fulfill by being commissioned to the project he works for. But even though you're saying he's also not an easy figure to reckon, so my question would be, what places and situations more specifically can we spot in your work? And what is maybe the main question you would like to ask your audiences? And is it only about satire? What is this architecture we're looking at? Sorry, it was a bit too long.
That's a good question. I mean, it's a lot of questions like rolled into one. That's always fun. I mean, I guess to start off with, like, what I'm trying to convey in the work or talk about through the work, and also the kinds of structures that appear in reality, but of course they're in the video, but they're slightly different. I think that at the core of my practice is an interest in using speculative fiction strategies that have been used in the past by feminist sci-fi authors such as Octavia Butler and Ursula K. Le Guin to essentially like exaggerate the conditions of the present into near future scenario in order to essentially expand the ways in which people understand the power relationships underpinning the world as we see it today. So when I say power relationships, I think quite specifically I'm talking about the relationship between architecture and the environment, between technology and nature, between culture and capitalism. Things that don't always get along in very easy ways, but things that are intimately connected with the forces of globalization and the way that our world is heading at present. So yeah, you're right. I mean, Swamp City is essentially set in this near future quasi-apocalyptic scenario. I've left it kind of up in the air just how far in the future this is, but if you ask me to pinpoint it, I'd say probably in the next 50 or 60 years. It's a future in which a lot of the East Coast, including New York City, is underwater. It's a future in which a lot of the West Coast, including California, is up in flames. And here in this world of extreme climate crisis, the Everglades in Florida has become this unlikely utopian enclave, a place where you can experience nature in its purest, unadulterated forms. I thought it was quite interesting in the work because I come from a background in architecture criticism. And then before that, I studied anthropology. So if you can kind of imagine an anthropology of contemporary architecture, that's the kind of area, I guess, I'm working in, you could say,
or something that I'm trying to achieve with my work is also understanding how all of these structural, like systemic relationships between nature, the environment, architecture, technology, and capitalism, how they also play out on an incredibly interpersonal scale. Like the kind of individual figure of the Starkitect, which the idea of the Starkitect has really come out of a product of globalization. When people talk about it, it's usually the idea of the Bilbao effect, a building as a kind of status symbol can generate cultural capital. And then it's only natural, us being humans and wanting to anthropomorphize that, and also the kind of ongoing God complex, let's say, of a lot of the humanities and the arts, including architecture and contemporary art, that we want to put a face to the name and we want to ascribe the kind of status and symbol of these buildings to their makers. We want the architectural mastermind. We want that figure. And yeah, essentially, I mean, Hedda Sterl talks about it too in a lot of her work, like the idea of the superstar artist that's being paid for like their platform, essentially. Like they get flown around the world and appear in all these different panels, and just having them there, you know, increases the attention of that event and increases the cultural capital of that institution. So essentially, I'm interested in evaluating the direction that I see a lot of our world already has heading in, and kind of picking up on particular areas of interest or structures of interest, such as very recognizable buildings, such as the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood, Florida, which is shaped like a giant electric guitar and was built just about a year ago now. So for me, being able to situate these incredibly iconic buildings in a semi-fabricated landscape, a landscape of the near future, a dystopian landscape to some, a utopian landscape to others, gives it a bit of like a sticking point. It makes it more believable than if it were entirely abstracted and devoid of any recognizable imagery. So in a way, it's getting people to kind of lean into an idea of the Everglades set in the near future being this like high-tech eco-tourist retreat that the 1% can pay for custom wellness tours and packages to kind of reconnect with nature and relocate their spirituality in this like preserved slice of the natural world. And I guess on the other end, I'm interested in looking at it from a perspective that's not entirely human, as Swamp City has multiple protagonists, one of which is, yeah, the troubled architect who wants to save the world but is also a slave to corporate capitalism. And then there's multiple other characters, including Alligator, that is refusing to leave the park, even though she's basically being driven out of it because she's considered too dangerous for all of the ecotourists. There is super sentient bald cypress tree that was brought back to life through Swamp City's biologists and scientists. They found a way to kind of resurrect her and turn her into this basically like a supercomputer for the park. So she's an interesting character. You know, she's like half artificial, half natural, let's say, and carries with her like a whole bunch of interesting complexities involving that relationship. So yeah, it's essentially like a two-pronged like mission, I guess, if you wanted to call it anything like that. Like my work is interested in creating these near future speculative scenarios to expand our understanding of the broader social, political, ecological conditions that structure our life today, that kind of speculates on where it's heading, to hopefully broaden people's perspectives and provide a kind of access or gateway into seeing how the future might turn out without it terrorizing them, because a lot of the time it is really fucking scary. And then doing that with a little bit of satire, again, like humor is a really important aspect of my work, like eases some of the like apocalyptic anxieties that are definitely there as well. And then, yeah, like the second half is to tell these stories or position these stories through the perspective of non-human narrators.
Thanks so much for this amazing answer. It seems like you're really connecting different notions, and science fiction, storytelling, and real life events, they all kind of overlap with each other. And you've mentioned also your admiration for other artists, such as Ian Chang or Agnieszka Kurant, or other artists you're writing about or you're working with somehow. And I would like to unfold maybe a little bit this part of your work, some of the specific themes, such as game engines or crowd or shared economies or cryptocurrencies. They are quite present. So would you like to say something more about how you see collaborative aspect of your work and
yeah,
how you situate yourself among some of these artists?
Yeah, sure. That's a really good question. Part of my interest in other artists' practices is like a bit of exploring interconnected themes, or let's say a topic like cryptocurrency that artists are investigating from multiple different angles. And in a way, this kind of construction of angles, this like co-development of a study of an idea, to me almost seemed like the most interesting aspect of contemporary art, the way that artists' work were already talking to each other. Like even without the presence of a critic, like they needed someone to come in and like connect the dots. Like, you know, definitely when I first started making work, and definitely to this day, I remain like highly influenced and highly inspired by a lot of the artists that you and I have talked about previously, like Ian Chang and Jenna Satella, Zadie Cha. And a kind of idea that I had been very interested in for the past couple years was understanding the new ways in which artists are reckoning with topics surrounding magic and mysticism and ritual and folklore and cosmology and mythology and all these kinds of cosmic ideologies and kind of magical thinking, and how specifically many artists were choosing to go at this body of research or body of interest through using quite advanced emerging technologies like artificial intelligence or like video games. Engines, using neural networks, kind of using this technology in a way that felt quite magical, in the sense that a lot of the time, it, you know, taking technologies that have been developed, like artificial intelligence, to perform a very straightforward, you know, I mean, like large scale task, like something that would take a human months or years to do at lightning speed, but ultimately created to fulfill a very human goal. And what was interesting about these artists is that they were using this technology, but they were basically backpedaling from that final goal or final destination for the technology, which was to serve this human task. And they were actually just letting it do its own thing. So they were maybe not completing the search engine of a neural net, and they were allowing it to arrive at its own conclusions or draw really crazy points of connection between different images, or create like a new hybrid image or a new hybrid text altogether. And I really liked the idea of technology being a kind of magic. It seemed like it was something that was interest or energy that was growing very quickly and across continents. Like it really wasn't contained to like one area, and not even to one generation of artists. Like, I mean, you can look back into the 60s and 70s and 80s. You know, there's artists like Rebecca Allen, who was basically the first person ever to work with VR. A lot of people know her for her music videos for Kraftwerk, I think in the 1990s. But yeah, there's Ian Chang developing software simulations of these kinds of mythical creatures, beings that play out in real time and develop their own consciousness. And whether humans look at them or not, they're still going to be there, like doing their thing. They're doing it right now. And I kind of saw myself in the context of these other artists as potentially a way, like maybe I could write something or create something that could kind of bring all of these different practices into conversation with each other. So yeah, I mean, a couple years ago, I wrote this text for Moose magazine called New Mystics, which was essentially looking at, I think it was 5 different artists who were combining magic and mysticism and ritual with advanced technologies like artificial intelligence. And it was quite a short text, but the idea felt really big and really exciting. And in the years following that, which I think was, yeah, 2019, I have now been developing a kind of multimedia iteration of that work that's a lot more expanded. It now has 12 artists involved. It felt really important to me that the format of the project, which is a digital like website that will be releasing written content and visuals and screenings and artist talks and lots of other good stuff over the summer, but tethered to the lunar cycle and also the celestial calendar. So the project launches on the summer solstice on June the 21st, and new texts texts are released every full moon, and then it kind of concludes, or it's finished by the autumn equinox, but it keeps going indefinitely as this kind of collective offering of sorts. It felt really important to me that it was a platform and a medium that really reflected the energy and the ideas behind these artists' work, because the text felt really limiting in a way. This, like, you know, printed essay, which has a deadline and has a print date, and after that it's just stuck in like a yellowing magazine, and there's no capacity for changing it, and there's no way of updating it or including more artists, or even, you know, thinking about different contexts. I mean, the past like 2 years, so much has changed in our world, and a lot of the artists that are now involved in this new project called New Mystics, you know, a lot of their work is directly responding to stuff that happened just last summer, like all of the, you know, movements for social justice around the world, calls for environmental justice, kind of like finding ways in which magic and mysticism isn't just a kind of inherited folk story, but actually something that is like a powerful tool for reshaping the present and like reconfiguring our role within the world today. I guess if I had any kind of role or position or how I saw myself in the context of these artists and this kind of practice, was just seeing a really inspiring, amazing cohort of people who were interested in similar subjects but approached it from radically different angles, and wanting to draw together these ideas in a format that was super accessible and engaging and multimedia and wasn't at all prescriptive, like not trying to push all of these artists into a box like maybe a curatorial like project might feel. It was something a bit more experimental and open and porous, and in kind of a tribute to the artificial intelligence systems that a lot of these artists are using. The project is developing a dialogue between myself and the artists and a new neural net called GPT-3, which is currently in beta phase. It's a language model. So basically it predicts text, but it's nothing like mm-hmm. any other previous language model you've ever seen. I mean, it.
So speaking of GPT-3, can you say something more about this, and how do you envision using this language generated by AI to yeah. be used in your work? Because New Mystics is a hybrid curatorial editorial project, and yeah, it's interesting how you're describing it. It's really a collaborative platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally the goal. I mean, it's such an experiment, honestly, and this whole project is like a massive experiment. So it's also a kind of exercise in trust. I mean, the artists involved, you know, it's 12 artists. I can mention a few of them offhand. Harun Mirza, Lawrence Leck, Ian Chang, Joey Holder, Zadie Cha, Zach Blass, Rebecca Allen, Jenna Satella. You know, it's artists. A lot of the times their work engages with topics around mysticism, folklore, magic, ritual, identity, and infuses it with kind of a high-tech approach. And yeah, a lot of them are interested in the ideas surrounding artificial intelligence and consciousness, or like non-human forms of consciousness, and maybe a means of communication that goes beyond language. So on one hand, GPT-3, I mean, it's a language model, so maybe we're not quite there yet in terms of like nonverbal communication. But on the other hand, I think GPT-3 answers a lot to this idea of non-human consciousness or more than human consciousness. And the way it does that, I mean, for anyone who doesn't know anything about GPT-3, it's basically a language model that's currently being developed in California by a company called OpenAI. They released GPT-2 not super long ago, but if you were to compare the two, GPT-2 and GPT-3, it's basically unbelievable. Both models were trained on the internet. They were products of the internet. They know everything that's ever been published online. But the key difference is that GPT-3, it's really kind of developed its own personality in a way, and just the breadth of which it can respond to questions. It goes beyond writing a kind of article or press release or textbook, which, I mean, is sort of, you know, ironically, the way that it's being sold and marketed right now is like, oh, it'll replace journalists. Like, there'll be no need for reporters anymore. But I mean, if you kind of ignore that or push beyond it, what it's actually capable of doing is really something quite extraordinary. It doesn't exist in this, its brain, or not brain, but its processor, I guess, doesn't really work in the same sort of segmented and fractionalized way that we process information. Like, I mean, we as humans have an entire like binary code of like where we sort things. We love to categorize. We love to split things apart and rationalize them and squirrel them away and only connect the dots where it feels safe or appropriate. And this AI has none, it's completely like uninhibited. It has none of those boundaries in check. It doesn't understand these caverns or voids of like disciplinary separation. It's happy to leap from a dream into a philosophical text, into a hardcore mathematical equation, into a like sassy diary entry. It's really just all over the place. And the ways that it ties together thoughts and ideas, to me, I mean, it almost feels like more human than we are. Like, I know that sounds silly and like whatever, like iRobot-y, which is like not the vibe I'm trying to go for. But I think in terms of asking ourselves like what we can learn from a type of awareness or a type of language that's very different from our own, I think that GPT-3 has a lot to offer. So that's GPT-3 in a nutshell.
Thank you for describing GPT-3 and its potential use in your work and other people's work. And I wanted to ask you about this interdisciplinary approach of yours. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on the blending of the fiction and social sciences in your work. As you've also mentioned, you studied anthropology before you pursued your education as an artist, and mm-hmm. your work is largely based on research and writing. So maybe you could tell us a bit how you see these influences.
Yeah, sure. I come from a background in visual anthropology, which in and of itself is this kind of hybrid of essentially like visual culture and anthropology. It's interested in a slightly newer, slightly less problematic, maybe hopefully understanding of anthropology that goes past a lot of the kind of dated concepts in sociocultural anthropology. But it's also interested in like an anthropology of affect. It's like an anthropology of experience. It's trying to get away from, in a sense, the over-academicized nature of the discipline. It's trying to get into a space of feeling, a space of images, and a more multimedia approach. So that was the kind of like basis that I signed on board with it. And yeah, I mean, I graduated from my anthro course now 6 years ago. And, you know, while I was a student, I guess my visual interest was the image of the city and the language of buildings and the kind of spatial experience of the urban environment. And of course, the kind of power systems and politics and aesthetic judgments that underpin it. So I was always super interested in looking at anthropology from a kind of architectural perspective. And I guess the way I sort of found my way into architecture, I mean, even though I didn't actually ever study it ever, it was always through this really kind of social interest, like in a shared experience of space. And I also, yeah, like I was saying earlier with Swamp City, got really interested in the many ways that architecture is used and abused in like a political sense, not just like straight up nationalism, but also kind of like post-global international relationships, how politicians and countries essentially use architecture as a tool of evidencing or proving their kind of cultural relevance or their cultural authority internationally. I think interdisciplinary always lends itself to a kind of, in my opinion, like a more advanced sort of form of criticism. And I don't mean it as in like, oh, it's like the best argument, but I think it's just like maybe the most complicated one. Because I feel like a lot of the time, like my work is never about, like, it never really feels about resolutions. It's kind of about pointing at all these different conflicting elements or like competing responsibilities or goals of architecture, let's say, and kind of exploring the many ways in which they contradict each other, and that it's really just not ever this sort of neat, easy package. And yeah, I mean, I guess that was definitely an issue that I had with anthropology while studying it. It always felt like it really fetishized or ritualized a kind of baseline understanding of people. Or like there was always some kind of, you know, like ritual to crack or like architectural site to uncover. And it felt really extractivist at the same time. Like not only was it interested in kind of laying out this really hyper logical, hyper pragmatic, like singular view of a culture or an artifact or like a ceremony or a social event or a building, it was also like super interested in kind of removing it from its context, like putting it on a pedestal, like isolating it inside of a library or a text and kind of closing the book and that being the end of it. Like it felt like everything was being written as a kind of like mic drop, like last word. And that to me felt really opposite from what I was interested in. And I mean, architecture had a very similar thing. I mean, it's always so oriented around the production of this single building, which is supposed to be like a sublimation of a grand idea of the architect. And it's like this idea of like the singular structure that's this like sweeping gesture that embodies so many different elements. And then once it's up and once it's over with after, you know, 20 years of construction or whatever, that's the end of it. And no one really likes to think about the day-to-day use, or I mean, architects especially hate thinking about like how their buildings are going to be occupied or if they'll even be standing in 10 years time.
When you were visiting the Alexandra Kasuba show in the National Gallery of Art, would you like to say something about the crown of the buildings you saw there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was super intense to go from the Alexandra Kasuba show, which is all about an architecture of the environment or an architecture of feeling, a kind of really poetic gesture around how architecture can conjure an atmosphere or an emotion through its kind of multisensory capacities. To go from that kind of really poetic and meandering and quite opaque, but really like, you know, generous and generatively opaque exhibition into the the surroundings of the National Art Gallery, which is basically this Blade Runner-esque car crash of metal and glass and steel. And I feel like I can't help but tie this brave new dystopian world of skyscrapers that were made 10 years ago or less, but look like they're from the 80s, to this like complete injection of capitalist fervor. I feel like is most obvious in the built environment, these new architectures of downtown Vilnius. But as a country, Lithuania has absorbed like uncritically in the past 10 years. I mean, I was, you know, meeting up with an artist recently, Anastasia Susanova. Her work is a lot about looking into the kind of evolution of gated communities in Lithuania and, yeah, the suburbs of Vilnius. And of course, like we all see the giant SUVs that people are driving around here to go on like walks in the park. I mean, it feels very like LA in some ways. So, I mean, I can't really be too critical, right? But I mean, it does definitely feel like there's this complete love affair with capitalism, kind of in this echo chamber where it's sort of ignoring or choosing to veto what we've seen about and heard about the kind of slow collapse, I mean, hopefully fast collapse of capitalism that seems to be happening elsewhere, with calls to dismantle it and ways that we've seen that it, you know, has actually just worsened so many of social relationships and cultural relationships that we have with each other. And yeah, I mean, it's capitalism on steroids here. And I think that that kind of sci-fi, futuristic, ultra-glassy, swooshy, like confident type of architecture, which already feels so dated, but is just a few years old. I mean, it says more than words, mm-hmm. I think.
And there will be more of this because there's also the emergence of new cultural institutions in the other areas of the city. And I think there will be other locations where these new museums will emerge, and I think this also affects the way in which the city is changing. But I would like to thank you so much for this conversation today, Alice, and I am really looking forward to seeing your video Swamp City in the Venice Biennale and the Russian Pavilion. So yes, thank you so much.
Yeah, and, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Can you just at the very end say a few words about the sound that we hear in the backdrop?
I worked collaboratively with a musician based in the Philippines. His name's Ken Yama. And we basically like designed the soundtrack together. We were referencing a few different like musicians, like while I was working on the project, Sophie passed away. So one of the songs is in tribute to her, as is some of the typography of New Mystics. There was like a lot of like stuff going on there where I felt like it was important to like give tribute. The kind of outro song of Swamp City is based on It's Okay to Cry, one of Sophie's songs. And yeah, I don't know, to me, like, the song felt, I mean, her song, I guess it, to me, it felt like a kind of like coming together as like a kind of effort of like collective healing. And like, just by acknowledging something being terrible, like, it doesn't mean that it's gonna get solved, but it's like the kind of the first step in an act of healing. And like, just being okay with like, because I mean, I think everyone, all of us feels a kind of environmental anxiety or an environmental depression like around the state of the world today. And to just be like, you know, having just watched this like 34 minute long movie, like the Swamp City piece, it doesn't have super optimistic ending. It doesn't have a pessimistic ending either. It's quite ambiguous, but kind of clearing the space at the end of the work for, as a kind of offering, as a space of collective healing, as a space of thinking about how we can do things differently, how we can work towards a more equitable environmentalism, which is, of course, like, I mean, environmental justice is tied to social justice and racial justice. So how, like, kind of understanding how all those systems are interconnected and offering that up at the end of the work.